Good evening, party line vloggers, tech people, welcome. Oh, writers too, sorry. Tonight we have the privilege of listening to Paul Marx, one of our own. And you spell that Marxz. I don't know how many times I got that wrong. So I'm going to start with his bio. Paul is an award-winning editor, technology blogger, and former punk rock drummer. Like all true nerds, he runs a web server. He has played drums since childhood. You can find Paul's stories in Uncharted Magazine, Amazing Stories, Creepy Podcast, Magnets and Ladders, and several anthologies, including Midnight Garden, Where Dark Tales Grow, and Wild Uncivilized Tales. His flash fiction piece, More Than Electric Sheep, placed first in Uncharted Magazine's AI Flash Fiction Challenge. And he placed second in the Roslyn Awards in 2022. He has co-edited the anthology 2024, Without Breaks, Fingers Crossed. He is a member of the Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers and Speculative Fiction Writers. His nonfiction pieces have appeared in the Braille Monitor. He writes a blog for Apple for disabled writers. His poem, The Thompson River Flows, placed first in the 2018 National Poetry Contest. You'll find Paul in Colorado sipping coffee with his wife, Dean. He still laments never getting his cat to play the drums. His newly published book, Solve It, A Guide for Blind Cubers, with a tactile Rubik's Cube, is giving directions with only text and is the only tactile or the only book for blind cubers. It will take the blind gamers from their first tactile cube to patterns and algorithms, finally solving the puzzle and maybe participating in competitions. Okay, Paul, that's it.
Good job, Carol. Wow. Thank you all very much for attending. And Carol, thanks so much for that excellent introduction. So, yes, we're all here tonight to talk about the new Cube book that has just been published, self-published by me just a few weeks ago, and all aspects of solving a cube as a blind person. But in addition to that, Carol asked if I would read a short excerpt from some of my science fiction. So I'm going to read a piece from an unpublished story. Right now I'm circulating it at different publishing markets, and it has not been accepted yet. The story is called The Widow and the Rain. It's a science fiction piece, but the subgenre is Weird West. So the setting is very much the 19th century American frontier, but it has a weird science fiction twist. Instead of one sun, there are two. So here we go, just the first few paragraphs of The Widow and the Rain. The valley was a scrub and rock hollow cut from a red-hot furnace, and Carradine City was cooking. It was that double sun overhead, two neutron stars, circling each other like dogs gone feral and raring to fight. Dust Cloud LeBlanc entered the draw on a Palomino stallion he'd won betting his last silver dollar on 9-10 offsuit. The small farm at the edge of town looked as tired and beaten as his horse. The split rail fence reminded him of the one he'd built with his paw, though not in as good a shape. Those collapsed top rails couldn't corral a tumbleweed. He'd asked to water his horse. Then he'd be on his way. He had a man to kill. As Dust Cloud approached, he spotted a woman stepping off the porch, dressed in black. How she could stand the heat, he couldn't hazard a guess. A jackrabbit hung by its hind legs from the awning. It had bled out a dark circle on the porch's wooden planks. Gold drew people to Carradine to tear it from the rocks with axes and sweat. Some found it, others died trying. Everyone else got by best they could. Small game like that rabbit might last a meal or two. She held it by its legs and cut the twine with a knife. Dust Cloud dismounted, brushed at his faded denims, and tipped his hat. "Ma'am?" She turned. Her gaunt face stood out from her dress and black hair like a pale ghost. Dust Cloud doubted she was older than his 18 years, but the frontier had aged her, dried her up, and spat her out. She squinted. Didn't lift a finger to shield her eyes from that demon double sun. "It's Mrs. Larson," she said in a gravelly rasp, then held up the rabbit. "Only got enough for me and my husband." So there you go, the opening to The Widow and the Rain. And if I ever get a nibble from a market and get that published, I'll certainly let you guys know about it on Writer's Party Line. Thank you.
Oh, very nice, Paul. Very good. Now we shall get into the main course, so to speak, which will be Solve It. And I have to tell you guys, I've solved a third of it. I bought a cube and I've been working on it. And with the instructions that are in the book that Paul wrote, I'm working it, and Cleora has completed it. So there's our incentive. Okay. Okay. Okay, your new book uses only text in it. No diagrams. Why is that important?
Well, first of all, thank you. Good question. And congratulations on solving a third of the cube. That's a great start. With your permission, I'd like to give you a shout out in my periodical newsletter. Because I love it when people actually make progress with my book. That's great. Yeah. As I was losing my eyesight to retinitis pigmentosa 5 years ago was when I started to become functionally blind and down to light perception, I bought a tactile cube. And much to my surprise, when I went to look up information on the internet or by guidebooks, they were all primarily visual. There were a lot of videos and there were a lot of images or diagrams. So I struggled with my remaining low vision to make sense of that information. But at the same time, I started making my own text-only notes, which is what you asked about, so that I would be able to remind myself later with just the use of a screen reader. So those text-only notes grew slowly into this book. About 2 years ago, I started to reach out to see if there were other blind cubers and did they have any resources. I found a small handful of us, a blind gentleman in Australia, a blind woman in Germany, and a blind college student in Poland. And in my email communications with these three, we decided that no, there was nothing else out there. And the best thing in the world would be not just a book that introduces people to the cube and gives them a beginner solution, but goes a little bit beyond that and tells them how they can decrease their solve time and actually introduces them to the concept of competitive speed solving. And so that helped me guide the direction and the form that the book finally took, which is a three-part book. Part one is an introduction to the cube, tells you where to get a cube or make one on your own, and then gives you a solution that a beginner solution that's relatively easy to memorize. And then part two goes beyond that and tells you how to get a higher quality cube that turns faster. And then it presents a second method for solving the cube, a second strategy that's much faster. And then finally, there's a third part, which covers how to clean and maintain your cube and how to make some just for fun patterns that will, impress your friends at the local coffee shop, right? Put a little checkerboard pattern on the cube with just a few easy twists. And so that's my book in a nutshell. And yes, okay. I do think that having a text-only book is important because this cube has been the domain of the sighted for too long. And there's no reason why we can't take a Rubik's Cube, put some tactile markings on it, and if we just had the information, we could solve it just like the sighted people do.
Do you see this as a equalizing factor between blind and visual people? That's something they can share?
I think so. Yes and no. On the one hand, the fully sighted cubing community that I plugged myself into as part of my research for this book, they welcomed me into their ranks and I've made many new friends. So yes, that was an equalizing force. At the same time, let's face it, I will never be able to solve as fast as a fully sighted person because they can look ahead while they're making turns to plan out that next move. And I have to complete a sequence of moves and then run my fingers over the cube. Everything comes to a standstill while I'm doing that, but the clock is still running, right? So they're always going to be faster than me. But I'm not competing against them. When I go to a competition, I'm competing against a clock. I'm just trying to see if I can be faster than I was last time. And there's a lot of fun and enjoyment in that. And it's good. It's good for your ego and your self-esteem when you go out there and you do that.
Okay. Well, what kind of cube do you use? I went on Amazon. I could not believe all the different kinds of tactile cubes. So what do you use?
It's remarkably easy to find a tactile cube. You can simply do a web search for tactile cube and you'll get search results. And a lot of the commercial cubes available are not really sold into the speed cubing market. but they're good for you to get started. So you can get a low-cost tactile cube for $10, or you can even go to a yard sale and buy just a regular Rubik's Cube made for sighted people and take it home, and you can put sticky bump dots on it and turn it into tactile. So I'll just take a minute to describe the Rubik's Cube. I know a lot of us have seen it, but some of us who might have been blind from birth haven't. So it's a cube about 2 inches, maybe a little bigger on a side, about the size of your fist, fits in the palm of your hand. Like any cube, it has 6 sides. For sighted people, each side has a different color. Each side is divided into 9 individual pieces, and when you rotate a side, the colors begin to scramble, and after a few turns, none of the colors on a side match anymore. And how you solve the cube is you try to twist it and turn it until all the colors match on a side again. So as a blind person, what you do is you have tactile markings on those 9 individual pieces on a side. So you'll need 9 identical tactile markings for one side, 9 different but still identical tactile markings for another side, et cetera, until you've got all sides different. So back to
Except
the question.
For one. You can have one that's blank.
Yeah, you want one side that's blank and one side that's maybe has round circles on it and another side that has dots. Another side that has square shapes, et cetera, something that you can feel. And so back to the question of what do I use? I use a mix of a couple different types of puzzles. One is whenever I get a new puzzle in the mail and I just want to start solving it, I go get those tactile bump dots and I stick them on there and I start playing with it. But if I'm going to plan on using that for competition and I want the textures to be optimal and to make sense to me and arranged in a way that's logical, like open circles opposite filled circles, so I can quickly tell the orientation of my cube, then I'm going to go to a friend who has something called a 3D printer, and I'm going to have them print tactile markings for me that conform to a specific size and height. And I'm going to super glue those onto the cube. And that's what I use. I use a high-end speed cube that I bought from a speed cube shop. And I use tactile markings from a 3D printer.
Okay. What about... You're talking about competitive cubing. I've got to know, what is your personal best time?
Right. When I go to a competition, you're at a solving station in front of usually a few spectators, and there's a judge there watching your every move. And guess what? You get nervous. So... still, I'm pretty proud of my best time. I can solve it in a minute 39 seconds. But when I don't have a judge breathing down my neck, I'm a little bit faster, but I've still never made it underneath a minute. Now, remember I told you that I connected with this college student in Poland who's blind? She mm-hmm. can solve the Rubik's Cube in under 30 seconds. So she has youth on her side, and I think she's been totally blind since birth. And she's been at it for a few more years than me. But she's blindingly fast, and I don't think I'll ever be that fast, to tell you the truth.
Well, what else is different about a competitive cube? Is it the mechanics? Is it... something else in the building of it?
The internal design is optimized so that it does not lock up, for one thing. So if you buy that, if you just search for Tactile Cube on Google and buy that $10 cube from Amazon, you might find that a side sticks every once in a while and you have to work it a little bit to unstick it. That won't happen with your Speed Cube. Another thing that they do is they put tiny little magnets inside that cube so that you can flick a side with your finger and it rotates 90 degrees and it just snaps right into place. It has little screws so that you can adjust the tension to make it a little looser or a little tighter. And they're easier to disassemble and reassemble. You can buy little bottles of lubricant, little silicone lubricant, to make them spin without any friction at all. They're really quite high-tech things. Some of them have little magnetized washers in there to add tension or relieve tension in certain parts of the cube. They're really quite complex little engineered things, and yet they're still only $20 or $30. So most people consider this to be a relatively inexpensive sport for young children to dive into. They can do that on their allowance, right?
Right. Well, some allowances. Now, what are algorithms and why are they important?
Well, that's a good question. So an algorithm is going to be a sequence of rotations that you're going to perform on the cube in order to move one or two pieces from one location to another. And this was something that I struggled with when writing the book. Most guides and web pages designed for sighted readers will illustrate that algorithm with images. They'll show pictures of the cube with arrows, doing a little counterclockwise circle, for example, next to the right side, and that's a counterclockwise right side turn. They'll also write out the algorithm, but one thing that they commonly do that's difficult for us as blind people is that when they have a counterclockwise turn, such as a right side counterclockwise, they'll write that as R apostrophe. And a screen reader doesn't read the apostrophe by default. And of course, you don't want to change that setting because then words like don't become Don apostrophe T, which you don't want. So what I did with my book is when I wrote out the algorithms, I used the mathematical prime symbol. So we see R prime for a counterclockwise right side turn. And most screen readers pronounce the prime symbol as prime. And guess what? When I'm talking with my cubing friends about the algorithms they use, they all say prime. They don't call it apostrophe. They say, Paul, you just do a R prime, U prime, RU, and then you've got those pieces in place. That's exactly how they speak. So that was one change that I made specifically to make it better for screen readers, was how I represented those algorithms. While I'm on the subject, before you jump to the next question.
Yes.
Anytime you're doing tech writing, and I know a lot of us have tech writing experience, it's always a good idea to explain things two or three ways. So the people that write cube content for sighted readers, they get one of those instantly just by doing images. Well, I don't have that luxury. So a couple of techniques I used are, one, I described the face of a cube as if it were a clock. There's going to be one piece at the 12 o'clock position, and you need to move it to that 3 o'clock position. And then I'll explain to them further that 12 o'clock position, that is the place where your upside and your front side meet, and you want to move it over to that place where your front side and your right side meet. So you can wade through the verbiage if you want, or you can listen to the clock analogy if you want to get an idea of how those algorithms are going to work. The other thing that I did was the beginner solution is in part two. Carol, if you can manage to get all the way through part one and solve your cube, then when you get to part two, you'll find I use another technique, which is starting from a completely solved cube, do this sequence of rotations to get into a situation that we need to find a solution for. And so they're kind of a backward set of terms to create a problem. And then you can feel that with your own fingers and you'll know exactly what that is without me having to describe it in any kind of convoluted, complex way. So those were some of the other accessibility accommodations I included in this book.
Well, you also gave some really good instructions when you said describing each piece of the cube, that some are two-sided, some are three-sided, and one is only has one side, the ones, the center ones. And that seemed to help me a lot. Because I said, oh, I got to find that one. So
good.
That's
good.
Just a little aside. Okay. Now, at the end of this, we'll be starting the Q&A. But before we do that, Paul is going to select a number of one of our callers, and we will be giving away your own cube and a set of instructions. But this last thing, where can people buy your instructions, and what format are they available in?
Yeah, let me tell you about that, because just before the call, I was playing around. I wanted to know how easy it was to find this book now. Are the search engines finding it? The answer is yes, they are. If you do a web search for Solve It, Paul Martz, you'll find links to Barnes & Noble, links to Amazon. You'll find a link to my personal webpage. You'll find a link to the Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers podcast where I was interviewed. You'll even find an article, a link to my article that I wrote for the Braille Monitor last August. So that's the easy way to do it. Solve It, Paul Martz. Another way is go to paulmartz.com and you'll find the link to the book real close to the top of the page. And it's on sale. If you go to Amazon, it's $2.99. They won't let me mark it down any lower unless I sign an exclusive deal with them, and I don't want to do that. So they're a dollar more than everywhere else. If you go to Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, etc., Apple Books, it's $1.99. And I didn't really price this because I wanted to get rich, obviously. I've got it priced pretty low. What I really want to do is make it available free to everybody who's blind. So I hope everybody on this call takes a moment to go to the NLS Bard webpage and fill out the book recommendation form and ask for this book, because the more requests we get, hopefully that will drive demand on. Let them know that there's demand to add this book to their catalog.
Well, if they add it to the catalog, the NLS, will they also put it in Braille? Because right now it's available in Braille.
Right. Okay. What format is it? Yeah, it's only in EPUB right now.
Yeah.
And I'd love to have it in an electronic Braille format, because NLS Bard now has that really cool print-on-demand service, right? And you can ask them to print out an electronic Braille file, and then you get to keep that for the rest of your life, which I think is great. But if you prefer audio, then you can certainly request it in audio. But I will warn you in advance that audiobooks work great when you're reading fiction or poetry and you want to be told a story or soothed emotionally with a poem, and you want that human voice. But when you're reading nonfiction, especially a complicated step-by-step set of instructions that's very, very tedious, if I might describe my own work, then it might be better to have it in a format like Braille or a screen reader where you can go back and read it a sentence at a time or only a word at a time, so that you're making sure that you're absorbing those instructions and following them precisely. Yeah. But I'm not going to stop you from requesting an audiobook. Go right ahead and hang yourself, people.
All right, let's open it up. Are there any questions?
Oh, we needed to do a drawing, right? And did you want me
Oh,
to
that's
pick?
at the end.
Oh, okay,
At
so
the end.
we'll wait.
And what I will ask, what I'll have you do is you'll pick a number. I have no idea how many people are listening, but maybe from 1 to 7 or 1 to 8, pick a number, and Annie will look down the list and see who is on the list for that number.
So
And they
everybody try
will.
to get in the middle because I'm going to probably guess a middle number.
So,
Nice
Paul,
hint. Okay.
this is Annie.
Okay.
Right now we have 12 people, including, so we're going to have to do a little bit of subtractions because you won't include me or yourself.
Right,
Um,
right.
so so probably one
No,
to
don't.
10 or Carol.
All right, yes. So
So.
we'll open it up to questions if anyone has any questions, and then if we have a little bit of extra time, I have a poem I'd like to read too. So, but let's
Excellent.
do questions
All
first.
right, first
Yes, the
hand is
time.
Nell Anthony.
Yes.
I was wondering if you were thinking about putting it on Bookshare as well, because Bookshare does have that. They have a Braille, they do have where you can do electronic Braille, mostly, on a what is it called? On a Braille
A Braille
thing.
display, a Braille
Yeah.
display. Yep.
Sorry, Braille display. That
That's
sounds so silly.
that
Yeah.
would be great. I never think of Bookshare because I'm not a Bookshare patron. So thanks for reminding me about that, Mel. I'll please, they have a book recommendation form too, much like
Yes.
NLS Bar does.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I've reached out to Bookshare through their contact form, and I said, "Hey, I'm an author with a book. I think you're going to want your catalog, and I'm ready to work for you." And crickets. And then I reached out to Colorado Talking Book Library as well, which is my local NLS affiliate library. And same thing. I filled out there, "Hey, I'm a longtime patron, and I'm an author, and I think you'd love to have this book in your catalog." And snoring sound. Yeah. So we're waiting. We're waiting for demand to drive both of these organizations to contact me. And I hope they do because I'd love to see this available for everybody to access.
Paul, before we get to the next person, this is Annie. I know Bookshare just redid their website and everything, and they do have a number that you
Phone
can
number.
call, and that's a, and you may have to kind of tickle them a little bit to get through to somebody, and then they'll probably help you out better if you get to a physical person. That's what happened to me. I had crickets until I kept on them, and then they finally got what I wanted. So,
Great idea. Thank you.
yeah, I know sometimes you think it should be easier, but Sally, you're up next.
Okay. Hi, Paul. I know very little about the Rubik's Cube. I've only been blind about 20 years, so I know what it looks like. I'm wondering what got you interested in it initially?
That's a great question. If you turn back the hands of time, I was 17 years old in 1980 when the Ideal Toy Company introduced the Rubik's Cube in the United States. And it just looked fascinating to me. And that's probably because my mom was a jigsaw puzzle fanatic. So I grew up in a house where she always had a jigsaw puzzle set up on a card table so that she could put it away and move it out of the way if we needed to, because we all, four of us in a little 1100 square foot house with a single bathroom, you know what it was like back in the 60s. And so I grew up in a house where people solved puzzles. And when I saw the Rubik's Cube, I thought that is something that I have got to have. Even before that, I was a little puzzle fanatic. There's the two twisted nails that you have to angle around at just the right way to link them together.
Right.
And there's those tiny little, I think they make them in like woodcraft shops, little wooden puzzles where one piece will slide out and then the whole thing will collapse. But then, it takes you 2 hours to put it back together, right? That's the kind of stuff that I've always loved. So I figured out how to solve it as a kid, as a teenager, because I had that kind of focus and energy. And then speed solving kind of took off after that, once I was out in college and starting my career. And I thought, oh, speed solving, who wants to bother with that? So I never really got interested in it. It wasn't until I lost my eyesight and got a tactile cube and I began to rediscover my love for this puzzle that got me interested in learning the speed solving techniques and getting plugged into the solving community. I've attended three competitions so far, local competitions here in Colorado, one last May, May of last year, one in December of last year, and one most recently in March of this year. And I'm making a lot of friends, and it's a lot of fun, and we all kind of cheer each other on. Yay, good job. And it's a great community.
Okay, thank you.
They've actually got me addicted to other puzzles now. There are, when you attend a speed solving competition, it's not just the Rubik's Cube, but they'll often have events, 9 or 10 different events. And one of them shaped like a little pyramid that twists into different arrangements. And another one is like a Rubik's Cube, but instead of 9 little pieces on a side, it's got 16 pieces on a side. So it's more complicated. And and they're all fun. Yeah. If you have no life like me. Boy, it does take a lot of time. When I'm looking at attending a competition, I have to say to myself, do I really want to spend that much time training and getting better and getting my speed up and all of that stuff? Or would I rather write science fiction? And usually science fiction wins out, I'm afraid. So I might not be doing too many more competitions, but I definitely want to stay plugged into that community.
Katie has a question, but I can't raise my hand.
We have somebody that came into the chat. Naomi wanted to ask a question.
Hi, Naomi.
Naomi, so could you unmute yourself and ask your question instead? It's a little easier for me instead of reading from the chat. So go ahead, unmute yourself and ask your question. You can use Alt A to mute and unmute. There you go.
Could you explain layman's terms how the various algorithms work to help solve the cube?
Naomi, I'm going to pay you back for coming in and asking tough questions. First, I have to let everybody know Naomi is in my speculative fiction writers critique group. Hello, Naomi. Thanks for being here. And when I was starting to look at different puzzles, there's this pyramid-shaped one that I told you about. It's called the Pyraminx. And I started talking to Naomi about it. She says, Paul, you can do the Pyraminx. It's easy. and you know what? She's right. So I will say that how these algorithms work, a lot of them are built from little subcomponents. For example, there is a 4-rotation sequence called Sledgehammer that is a right counterclockwise, a front clockwise, a right clockwise, and a front counterclockwise. And then there's another one that has kind of a strange name. It's called the sexy move. And that's a right and up, a right counterclockwise and an up counterclockwise. And each of these move a small subset of pieces without disturbing the rest of the cube. And by chaining these sequences and lots of similar variants together, you're able to isolate and target exactly which pieces you want to move or change orientation or whatever it is you're trying to do with the piece. And I didn't think these up. Some other geniuses did years ago. They worked out the different situations that you might encounter, and they started to list the different ways that you could address that situation. And it's not just a one size fits all either. Sometimes you might come up with a situation, you have a choice of four or five different algorithms that you can apply. And it's a matter of what's the one that's most comfortable for your the position of your hands, or which one are you most used to. It's really way, the deeper I get into this, people, the more I know what I haven't learned yet. It's really quite spectacular. You think of who on earth is spending so much time solving the Rubik's Cube? Well, a lot of really smart people are doing this, and they're this tiny little secretive subculture that doesn't really get a lot of popular attention in the media. And it's quite amazing when you dive into this end of the pool.
Well, Paul, this is Annie. Thank you so much for that explanation. It's kind of like good fodder for a speculative fiction story, don't you think?
I keep wondering how I can put a Rubik's Cube into a speculative fiction story. Yes, definitely.
Oh, wonderful. We have a couple more hands. I know Alice raised her hand when Kate asked if she could ask a question. So we'll go with Alice first, and then we'll go with Kate.
All right. Thank you. And good evening, everyone. And Paul, I am curious, when you are participating in the competitions, are you participating by age groups, or how does that work?
I'm afraid not. I pretty much have to compete along people like, there's a young gentleman in Colorado Springs here that I've met. His name is Truman Clack. He's 9 years old, and he's one of the top competitors in the nation. He has a YouTube channel with over 300,000 subscribers.
Oh my goodness.
And Truman and I go to the same competition, and we're ranked in the same list. So there might be 80 people in attendance, and Truman is up there in the top five, and I'm down there in the bottom, you know, somewhere between 75 and 80. But that's okay. Because like I say, I'm not comparing myself to him. He has youth and eyesight on his side. And he also has all the time in the world to focus on it. He's not trying to write science fiction and maintain a web server like I'm doing, right? He's not married. But it's great to get to know those people, because they know so much. And when you talk with them, you hope for those little pearls of wisdom. Just give me one little tip to help me do this one little algorithm faster, because I know I'm so slow compared to you. And they're more than willing to share their information.
Thank you. And I also wanted to ask you, Paul, do you remember a Rubik's Type Cube or a Rubik's Wannabe that was sold by it was Quaker Oats or whatever. It was Chex cereal. Do you remember that one? And it had different pictures on each of the faces of the cubes.
I don't remember that specific one, but I know there are a lot of variants. At the last cubing competition I went to, a woman came in and she had a set of fruit. And each piece of fruit was a Rubik's Cube, an apple, a peach, an orange. She had a banana that wasn't quite a Rubik's Cube. She said it was more like a puzzle called Square One. And it's really quite interesting. Some of them are in the shape of a person's head. And some of these people who compete, they have their own 3D printers. As I told you earlier, I use them to print the tactile markings for my cubes. Some people print their entire puzzles with their 3D printer. They design them with 3D modeling software, and then they print the parts and assemble them and come up with their own custom cubes and custom designs. These people are just remarkable. I can't say that enough. It's quite a crowd to rub elbows with.
Is it a quiet atmosphere, or
It's very friendly, yes.
And then finally, I just wanted to ask you, how many pages is the book?
Well, it's about a little over 15,000 words, so I'm trying to map that into pages. what's it, about three pages per thousand words, so about 75 pages.
I would say 80 pages, yeah.
Yep.
That sounds right. Because I thought it would be perhaps, you know, good to read on the HumanWare e-reader that people have from the library, or
okay,
you know, some people have ZoomX or whatever, but that would be very doable then for many people to read it that way. Thank you very much, Paul.
You're
good
very
luck
welcome.
With your book.
And I believe it was Mary Jo in the Writers Party Line BOE group that I was speaking with who said the most accessible format, she used it for the group anthology, was EPUB, because you can read it in Braille on a Braille reader, or you can read it with a screen reader. And if it's available through Smashwords, then you can buy a DRM-free EPUB mm-hmm. that you can load into any app you want, Voice Dream Reader or anything. So
that is correct.
Yep.
Yeah. Kate has a question. And then after yes. Kate is Marlene.
Okay. Thank you, Paul, for your presentation.
You're welcome, Kate.
When our grandson was 10, he did our regular shape Rubik's Cube and he solved it. And my husband, sighted husband, looked at it, and he did. He had all the sides just right where they should be.
Yes.
Eventually, the little Dickens admitted that he'd pulled the stickers off and rearranged all the stickers. He matched. My question is my cube damaged?
I actually cover that sort of in my book is in three parts, part one, part two. Part three covers disassembly, cleaning, and reassembly. So if your cube is just scrambled and you can't do a thing with it, part three tells you how to take it apart, and then you just have to put it back together in the right order.
Okay, but we're not going to know what's the right order because all the stickers are moved.
I'm afraid not. Yeah. So you have to have tactile okay. markings if you're blind, right? Yep.
Thank you. You'll get a tactile cube. By the way, that will be the offering for today. The cube that you get will be a tactile cube. Over.
We're going to do a drawing for that. Okay. Was there one last question? And then
yes,
we got to do the drawing.
Marlene Massat.
Fascinating. My question is, since you're familiar with different types of puzzles, do you use puzzle techniques in your writing? Thank you.
No, I haven't figured out how to do that yet. Boy, the problem for me is really separating my tech writing brain from my fiction writing brain. I know this isn't answering your question directly, but when I'm tech writing, the job is to tell everything as explicitly and logically as possible and as clear as day. And when I'm doing fiction writing, the challenge is to strategically hide pieces from the reader that will result in a more compelling and intriguing story.
Yes.
And those two parts of my brain don't overlap. and when they do, and the tech writing comes out in my fiction writing, I have to go back and find ways to rewrite it. Sometimes the tech writing, the logical sequential part, is really good in a first draft for fiction because I'm telling the story to myself. But then I'll go back and I'll revise it later and I'll find a better way to tell it.
Yeah, I write mystery, so the clue thing is something I really like. You can look up techniques for mysteries, and that may help a little bit. Or sometimes they'll use poetry, where either the villain writes poetry or, you know, leaves clues that the people have to figure out to solve. But I don't know if that helps any, but
you've given
you so
me really good ideas for ways to integrate this puzzle into my fiction writing. Yeah,
great.
Thank you.
Okay.
I have been on mystery kicks before, where it's like, okay, I'm going to read everything Agatha Christie ever wrote. But that's not my usual gig. I'm usually more science fiction. So
clues inside the cube.
So let's pick a number at random.
One to nine. I'm going to pick a number from 1 to 9.
1 to 9. We lost some people. So I'm going to pick 7.
All right. Hold on. I've got a
lucky number 7.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. All right. So I'm going to double check this. Everybody be quiet. Oh, see that? Hang on.
They move around.
One, two, three, four. Yeah, it's moving around. I'm going to have to mute all and then do it. Sorry, everybody. Everybody will be muted, including you, Paul and Carol, but you can unmute yourselves with Alt A when I'm done. Hold on a second. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Seven, eight, nine. All right. It's Marlene Massat, who's the winner. Everybody, you can unmute yourselves with Alt A if you want.
That's great.
Yeah. I had to do a little adding and subtracting but so we got it. It's not the optimum way that I would like to do this, but it worked.
Marlene, you won. Why would you want
to
give your cube away?
Everyone should have a cube.
I tried the colored one once, and once I got it scrambled, that's as far as it got. I hope you're going to read your poem. I want to hear that.
Does everybody want to hear it? I've read it to you guys before.
Yeah, and I want to make sure Carol can get unmuted.
Yeah. I wanted to mention, if anyone here ever happens to get serious about competitively speed solving, I'm now in touch with someone who has started buying good, high-quality speed cubes, modifying them with textures for the blind and reselling them. And her website is texturecube.com. And she has just opened that website up. We've been exchanging emails and looking at ways to cross-market our products. So texturecube.com.
Thanks for sharing that. Carol hasn't gotten unmuted yet.
That got into the recording. I wanted to make sure that got in, and then I'll do the poem after Carol says hi.
Oh, she left the meeting by accident.
Oh,
all right.
Should I go ahead and read it?
Yeah, go ahead and read it, and she'll probably come back in a second. So
this was written for the 2018 National Braille Press Poetry Contest. I was in Susan Fisher's Hadley group, which is where I met Carol Farnsworth and ultimately how I came to become associated with Behind Our Eyes. Carol was entering a poem. The theme for the poetry that they wanted was nature, and I immediately thought of a nearby river here in Colorado. My poem is called "The Thompson River Flows." A stream of snowmelt dances and cascades, abandoning her mountain crib arrayed in quilts of columbine. From Alpenglow's magenta light, the Thompson River flows. Mature and rebellious, full of trout and mood, her rushing muscles wear the bedrock smooth. Sedate, she suns her rippled face, a queen with eddies crowned by autumn leaves citrine. With heavy rain and sullen charcoal skies, her turbulent and hostile waters rise. She floods a canyon, showing no restraint. Then, apathetic and aloof, she wanes. In time, adorned in prairie grass, she meets the South Platte far from Rocky Mountain peaks. Embracing her, he soothes her fickle throes, and in his arms, the Thompson River flows. Thank you, everybody, for attending my release party tonight. I really appreciate that.
Beautiful poem. Very vivid.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Beautiful very good. Imagery. They're still waiting for Carol to come back. Lisa, did you want to say a few words about Behind Our Eyes before we end?
Okay. I guess so. Behind Our Eyes is going to celebrate their 20th anniversary next year. We have so many programs, and I will probably forget them all, but we have our magazine, Magnets and Ladders. We have three anthologies that have been published. We have Sunday night calls twice a month on our party line, and sometimes we have speakers, and sometimes we have workshops. We have all kinds of programs there. Of course, we have our email lists, and we have our genre list, which each month it's a different genre. We have our marketing list, and we have our regular party line list. We have our website, behindouryards.org. Is that right? Yeah. We have Writers Exchange, where you can take classes for free that one of the members will give. Maybe three or four times a year or something like that. Okay, what did I forget? There must be something. Did I forget anything?
The book launches. The write-ins.
Oh, the book launch. Well, the book launches is right here. We're doing
Reader's Workshop.
Oh yeah, Reader's Workshop. I knew there's so many things. I should write these things down. Yeah, I should. Yeah, I need to write it down. The Reader's Workshop is fun, where once a month we get together and read short prose and poetry, and people comment on the reading style. It's sort of a practice for when we read in public. And what else did you say besides the Reader's Workshop?
Write-ins.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. No. Every Friday, Nell has started write-ins where we get together and we first have a session in which we talk to each other about what we're working on, and then we spend an hour writing, and then we come back and, you know, sort of check in with each other on what we have written. It's a really nice get-together. I just want to thank you for the really informative book launch today, and it's very interesting. I think I've seen a Rubik's Cube, but not very often. I wanted to know you have to be good at math in order to be able to solve it.
I don't think so. You have to have memory which I think a lot of us do as blind people. If we're going to head out of the house, we can't just set something on the counter and know that we're going to see it on the way out to remind us. We have to remember it in our head. So we're already using our memory. And a lot of us who are old enough but remember the pre-cell phone days when we would remember, 10 or 15 different phone numbers in our head. So that's kind of the big thing you need. And then for tactile cubing, you need that ability to that tactile dexterity. It's not going to help you read Braille any faster. It's not going to help you remember your contractions, but it is going to help you. It helps me find things faster. And something that I need to improve on all the time is I identify faster by touch.
Oh, good. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you guys for the great opportunity. I really enjoyed this chance to talk to you all. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you. Is Annie. I'm going to close the meeting.
Oh, I'm muted. I'm here. Just in time to say goodbye. But Paula, you're going to read your poem before we go.
You missed it, Carol. Oh.
Yes. Right.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah. But well, Carol, thank you so much for...
muted.
Thank you so much for working with me on setting up this book launch and working out the interview and interview questions. I really appreciate all the work you put into this.
Yes, thank you, Carol.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Paul.
Take care.
Okay.
Have a good evening.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, all.